Hello, and thank you for attending KVSC's discussion and program launch of Trial by Mob, the Duluth Lynchings. I'm KVSC radio station manager Joe McMullen-Boyer, and I'm deeply honored to have been able to work on this project for nearly 2 years. From the first idea stage to the recording and outreach stages, all with such compassionate and thoughtful colleagues, students, and professionals. KVSC thrives on collaborative projects such as Trial by Mob. The project began as a conversation with criminal justice professor Barry Schreiber, who is on the panel, developed into a program that involved dozens of volunteers, students, actors, sound engineer, director, and many KVSC staff. Aside from the collaborative spirit of the campus radio station, we were also able to bring to the table grant funding, state-of-the-art technology and studios to support the recording, and honoring our station's educational mission of serving our students and the community, and a steadfast belief in social justice and equity. Trial by Mob, the Duluth Lynchings docudrama is made possible by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Legacy Fund, as passed by the Minnesota voters in 2008. Thank you, voters. Tonight, our panelists include Michael Fido, author of Trial by Mob, the Duluth Lynchings, the docudrama, based off of his book, The Lynchings in Duluth. Deborah Lee, she is the lead community anti-racism education or CARE initiative at St. Cloud State University. Thank you. Carol Cooley, she directed Trial by Mob, and she's also the costume shop director here at St. Cloud State. And Barry Schreiber is professor of criminal justice, who has used Michael Fido's book for many years in his classroom with his students. I'd also like to recognize Nick Hendrickson. He is a 2012 alum, and he mixed down the production in well over 90 hours of post-production for the docudrama. Nice to have you here, Nick. Towards the end, he will be helping with the Q&A if you have some questions of the panelists. The panelists will present their connection to this project and will feature small audio clips of the docudrama between their remarks. We're also allowing time for Q&A at the end of the program. Once the presentation and questions are done, we would like you to join us in the lobby of the theater for the continuation of the conversation. We'll have some coffee, tea, cookies, and bars, so please feel free to enjoy that after if you want to continue the conversation with your peers here tonight or the panelists. I also want to share with you that I've been in contact with the director of the Duluth Human Rights Commission and co-chair of the Clayton Jackson McGee Memorial Board. Members were unable to be here this evening, but we'll be sharing the docudrama with them on their website. The next time you visit Duluth, please make sure to take time in your trip to visit the memorial built to honor Elias Clayton, Isaac McGee, and Elmer Jackson, the three young men who were lynched. We also have a website information listed on the program that was handed out this evening where you can learn more about the memorial and the educational resources they provide online. Trial by Mob was also part of tonight's presentation. This presentation tonight will also be airing on Sunday, March 1st, as well as Trial by Mob on KVSC 88.1 FM. It's also available as a podcast on kvsc.org. The docudrama will begin at noon on Sunday, followed by 1 hour of this discussion. Please see the handout provided for details on how to access the podcast. And lastly, the program is not suitable for young children. So we suggest maybe ninth grade and older for listening to Trial by Mob. At this time, please welcome Michael Fido, author of Trial by Mob, and our first presenter.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks for coming this evening. Every time there's something like this, a discussion on race, usually the audience is comprised of folks like yourself, and for people like us who are up here, it's like preaching to the choir. Beyond that, all of us here know people who aren't in the choir, and the effort is well worth it to try to engage those people as well. A week ago today, I was at a TED Talk in Jacksonville, Florida, and one of the presenters talked about the inherent racism that everybody experiences and feels and thinks, perhaps. And she had a provocative question that she asked of the audience, and that was, in your circle, are there any people who are not like you, who are people of color, if you are Caucasian, for example? And you could kind of sense the audience feel a little bit uncomfortable with that. But I'd just like to leave that in your minds for you to ponder as we go through the rest of this evening. June 15, 1920 was a signal event for northern Minnesota and perhaps the state of Minnesota, because on that evening, as many of you know, three young black men were hanged on a street corner in Duluth, Minnesota. There were other lynchings in the North during this era, but it was the size of that crowd that really drew a lot of attention at the time. And the mob was estimated at between 5 and 10,000 men, women, and children. When I talk to audiences like this, I often open with a reference. The Zen philosopher says, if a tree falls in the forest and nobody was there, did it make a sound? And bringing that to the incident that we're discussing this evening, if an event happened and nobody remembers it, did it in fact happen? And with the case of the Duluth lynching, it was an episode that was forgotten. History books about the state of Minnesota, published after 1920, do not mention the incident. Even another large volume titled Crime in Minnesota did not mention this incident. For most Minnesotans, for a couple of generations, this was a non-event. People didn't know a thing about it. And I knew about it as a young boy because my mother mentioned it to me. But it was so long ago, I have no context. I have no idea why she brought this to my attention. It seemed to me, in trying to get my brain around this, that it was an incidental mention was all. But somehow it stuck. And I was born and raised in Duluth. I spent my first 25 formative years there. And I wasn't living there at the time I started to put this together, but I was at that time a relatively fledgling writer, and I thought I wanted to write a novel, and for some reason I was going to set the novel in post-World War I northern Minnesota. And as I was fooling around trying to come up with characters and develop a plot, I remembered that my mother had said something about this lynching. And I thought, oh, that will maybe jumpstart something. I wasn't going to write the novel about the incident, but I wanted to just include it somewhere in my text, and I was going to have one or couple of my main characters be eyewitnesses to this. In order to figure out whatever happened then, I went looking for the book that I thought must have been written 50 years prior about this incident, only to learn that no such book had ever been written. No librarians had heard of anything like this. In fact, nobody said they remembered hearing about anything like this. Finally, I managed to get someone down at the State Historical Society who said, yeah, we have a file on that you'd be welcome to look at. And it was a very thin file, a manila file, and it consisted of, I think, two newspaper articles and a pamphlet. Well, from there, I was able to access the newspapers of the era. And I spent two or three Saturdays in the archives at the State Historical Society, and and very quickly filled a spiral notebook with notes. And at some point, I decided, why write a piece of fiction that sort of tangentially references this when this has not been documented at all? And so I abandoned the novel and set about to write this particular story, which is now known as The Lynchings in Duluth. This is the third incarnation of the book. I began researching this story in about 1973, took a couple of years working on it part-time. It was published in 1979. That was the first incarnation of this book. And the title at the time was given by the publisher of the book, a small company in Orange County, California. And he suggested the title of the book, which was taken from a quotation given by someone in the book, after martial law was declared in Duluth. This individual said, "Why all the fuss? After all, they was just niggers." And that was the title of the first incarnation of the book. It was a bad marketing decision. And it was a bad marketing decision because no one would go into a bookstore and ask for that. If they didn't see it on the shelf, they would just walk out. And it was also not a good idea for the publisher generally. At the time I was, just before I thought I might get a royalty check, I got a letter from a lawyer saying that this company was on the verge of bankruptcy and was about to collapse. And in fact, several months later did. And not much happened with the volume that was printed. Got a couple of negative reviews, including one from the Minneapolis Tribune, in which I'm quoting almost exactly. The reviewer said something to the effect that this was an event that was better left forgotten, but along comes this Fido fellow to bring it up and rub our noses in it all over again. And on the heels of that, the publisher went bankrupt, and I thought that was the end of it. About a dozen years later, somebody called and offered to reprint this book. Well, nobody else had been interested, and so I said, sure, go ahead. This man was a noted publisher internationally, but what he had been in the past was a publisher of very lavishly illustrated children's books, and this was neither something to be lavishly illustrated nor a children's book. And he also went bust. So I don't know if it's this book forcing two people out of the business, but it happened twice. The third time was the edition that the State History Historical Society and their Borealis imprint took in the year 2000, and it remains in print to this day. And we're getting far more positive responses now than it got back in the late 70s. Part of the problem in the late 70s was a number of the people who would have been involved in this story. Either they were still alive or their children were still alive, and people were embarrassed by this. They felt ashamed, and so they didn't want it to happen. I had some experiences, though, with some racist mailings. They came anonymously, and I never felt threatened by them, but I did report them. Several years later, the person who was sending these was unmasked by a member of the Twin Cities Press. was a man named Elroy Stock, who was wealthy. And he had given $500,000 to Augsburg College, expecting to get a building named after him. But he was unmasked at this time, and tax issues made it very difficult, if not impossible, for Augsburg to return his donation. So they kept the donation, and kind of in a fitting turn, they designated this racist's gifts to be used for minority student scholarships, which continues to this day. Mr. Stock has subsequently passed away. Writing and publishing the book and being involved with discussions, perhaps such as this one over the years, has been life-changing for me in ways that I could not have foreseen at all at the time I was putting this together. I've participated in numerous discussions throughout the Midwest and in other parts of the country as well. And have been, I think, speaking as a person of privilege, have been able to connect with minority people in ways I would not have had I not written this book. It's been eye-opening. I've been told and have subsequently witnessed subtle forms of racism that I never would have noticed before. Among them being, you go to a convenience store, you pay for your gas and a bag of chips, and you get your change from the clerk. And very often a person of color also does the same thing, but the change is quite often pushed across the counter to that person rather than handing it to them. And I'd never paid any attention to anything like that before, and I see it with some frequency ever since. There's a story I was told when I was at Stillwater, Minnesota High School about 10 years ago. And in this, the woman who directed or was a minority student counselor told me that she had a young man who had been stopped by police 37 times during the months of September and October. This young man had been stopped either walking to or from school or to or from his part-time job. And it was walking through neighborhoods where people of color hadn't been seen before, and every time the kid was there, somebody would call the police. And one might ask, well, could that have also happened to a Caucasian kid? Possibly, but 37 times? Highly unlikely. So the racism is still all around us. And none of us are colorblind. One of the things the TED Talk woman brought up was when we're talking with or connecting somehow with people who are ethnically different from us, is that we should look them in the eye. And she said, when you look people in the eye, you see something other than their otherness. You see their humanity. And I think that's maybe the thought that I would like to leave you with this evening.
We're going to move now to our director of the program, Carol Cooley. She directed Trial by Mob, the radio docudrama. She's going to share her insights and experience with this project and how she worked with Michael Fido and the actors.
Hi. It was last spring going into summer, and I was starting to do diversions at KVSC as an extra shift. And Joe was at the station, and she came up and asked me, would you be interested in directing this? And I was like, I didn't even know what it was. I said, yes. Because I love radio. Part of my sort of former life before I got into costuming was doing radio, and particularly producing news and magazine format kinds of shows. I'd never directed a piece this large with this many individual actors and of definitely of the weight of this particular story. And I've always been drawn to stories, and particularly difficult ones that come from where we live. And as a theater person, that's something that I like to seek out. And so Joe shared the script, and then I read it, and I was like, yes, definitely, I need to do this work. And so I started in and reread it and started writing questions and asked to have a meeting with Michael and his lovely wife, Judy. And we sat down, and I presented questions about, here I am, I'm just, you know, I'm going to be the sort of unsophisticated listener, and I'm going to ask things that came up to just try to clarify and mostly talk about how to learn more about Michael's path with this, to learn more about how I could handle the story. And you might think that a director's job is very glamorous. It's not. It's a lot of making charts and lists and a lot of sort of sorting through all of the minutiae, the factors that you need to put everything together. And so that's where a lot of my time became taken up with. And one of the questions I asked at that point of Michael was, have you heard this yet? Because of being radio and a story that you hear, I wanted to make sure that he had heard what his script was. And so one of the first main projects that we did is we organized a reading with volunteers from KVSC and just sat down and read through. And that was helpful. And then we started looking for who would be the talent. And we were very lucky in producing Granite City Radio Theater, and particularly with the work Eric Webster does with Shades Brigade, we sort of had a built-in core of professional actors that we could hire and bring into the project. Initially, I broke it because we did it with very few people. We didn't do it with, like, you know, a huge crowd or a huge mob. And so trying to double up roles, and then as at the reading, and then as we moved into the production, that was probably one of my biggest juggles, because some people couldn't come, some people, you know, there was just a lot of fluctuation there until we finally sort of sorted out who could play which characters. Another aspect of it that was very important was that in reading it, the mob itself is a character. And one of the reasons why I was attracted to the script, and I think it's important that we hear this story, is that we don't know how far away we are from being a mob. This can happen now. This can happen here. And so I wanted to find a way to bring the mob into the story and make them live. And we did that technically with a number of our volunteers, and basically pulled out, we had a sort of our own mob script. We recorded over 2 days, and I think we did 3 full takes, as well as the mob. And so that was a lot to cram into a short amount of time. And another question that came up for me as I was working with the script, and I keep asking myself and wanted to know if anybody in that mob, I think the woman in the blue suit asked herself that, is that you hear a repeated question. And it's repeated more in the book, is what if this was your sister? What if this was your daughter? What if she was your wife? Okay. of the young woman who was allegedly raped. And my question after reading the book was, what if he was your son? What if he was your brother? What if he was your father? I get moved. It was an interesting process because for all as heavy as this work and content and all of what is in here in this story, as heavy as that is, we were a very, I think it brought us together as performers working on it in a way that we might not have in a lighthearted piece. I think there was much more investment. I think everyone was focused and really with the story. And then other than that, it really turns into Nick's work of editing and producing and finding all of how the rest of that shape gets sort of sanded down and smoothed out so that we have the piece that we have now. I don't know.
Could I ask one question, Carol? Could you talk about how you spoke to the actors to get them in the right frame of mind and brought them to the darkest parts of this production?
I did a lot of research, and so I wrote a number of short characters, sort of synopses, and shared that with them. I shared photographs with them as well, particularly the photograph that's the postcard, if you haven't seen it. It's horrific. I realized that recently, over winter break, I listened to the beginning episodes of Ken Burns' Jazz, and I had thought I had seen that image before, and it's in there. And I was like, ah, okay. And working with the actors, too. I mean, some of this was physically, you know, it's like, make it louder, make it softer. We did takes, you know, a number of takes frequently to find the right level of emotion and commitment. I learned something wonderful from one of the professional actors about just the physicality of having to push against something, how it changes your voice. That was lovely. And really was trying to share and make our space as safe as we could, so that everyone would be able to, perform to the best of their ability.
Yeah? Thank you.
That answer that? Thanks.
Joining us now from the panel for segment three is criminal justice professor here at St. Cloud State University, Barry Schreiber. He's going to present his connection to Trial by Mob and Michael Vito's book, and the use in the classroom, as well as some of the perspective of the case.
Great. Thanks, Joe. How nice to see you here tonight. It's cold out. It's dark out. There's a cold going around, which borders on having a cough that is tubercular. Yet you dare to come among a group of interested people to hear what's been done with the lynchings in Duluth. The book, The Lynchings in Duluth, is about you. The book, The Lynchings in Duluth, is about me. And it's about our reaction and perception to other people. I came across the book shortly after its second incarnation, I believe, Michael, when I read a book review, I believe it was in the Star Tribune, and I thought, Lynchings Duluth, surely this must refer to Duluth, Georgia, not Duluth, Minnesota. But I read on and was disappointed to find out that indeed it was about the city many of us know and love, the San Francisco of the Midwest, a city that Michael Vito grew up in, a city where I was a college professor for 3 years at UMD and knew nothing of this incident. I did a little investigation and was fortunate to get in touch with Professor Vito and read the book, was smitten by it, and thought this is important information for students of criminal justice to have. Criminal justice textbooks typically describe the structure, functioning, and actors of the criminal justice system. how the system is supposed to work. And this was a case, like others of recent note, where the system did not work, and the system could not protect people who were supposed to be under the custody, care, and protection of law enforcement in the justice system. So I think it's important as we grow older to recognize that the way things are supposed to work isn't always the way that they do work. And I assigned the book in my large lecture class. I assigned the book in my online CGS 111 course also. And I ask a number of questions of the online students in the CGS 111 class about the book. Among the questions that I've asked are these. What did you know about this incident before reading this book, the Lynchies in Duluth book? And the typical response is, I've lived in Minnesota my whole life, and I've never heard about this. And why haven't I heard about this? This is a notable event. A second question, why is the incident not better known in Minnesota? And the usual answers come up, and I want to pull Michael for just a moment in my precious 15 minutes of stardom here. I'll yield to my esteemed colleague, Professor Fido. And would you please recount a small incident, but sometimes we grasp the truth of a reaction to a situation by a glimpse of truth. The incident I'm referring to is when your father had a copy of your book on his coffee table and invited a woman to come to his house. I think you know what I'm speaking
about. Right, yeah. It was indeed my father's copy, but it was my stepmother had invited a neighbor over for coffee, and the copy of the book was on one of the coffee tables, and she looked at the cover, and very startled, she says, "My goodness, that's Tom." And she pointed to a man who was pictured on the cover of the book in this grisly lynching tableau. Tom was her husband. They'd been married for 52 years, and he had since passed away. But in all those 52 years of their being together, she had never heard any mention of this incident, and it was quite a shock to her to see her husband on the cover of the book.
But Tom was in that horseshoe of participants in the mob around the lamppost from which one of the bodies was still hanging. The two others were on the ground at the foot of this. And Tom was one of those who was leaning in to be sure that his photo was imaged with the rest of the crowd, as this was the trophy shot, if you will, of what this group of vigilantes had thought was justice. He was not hiding. It seemed like a good idea at the time. But very shortly thereafter, I think Tom and many other Duluthians recoiled at what had happened. And I think the easiest answer is there was shame attached to it. This seemed like a great idea when there's 5,000 people around me demanding justice. But the day after, 20 years after, 52 years after, it was something not to be spoken of. And had it not been for the man you see before you, chances are none of us would know about the lynchings in Duluth. And we've taken this story from the book that was republished in 2000. By the way, the Minnesota History Center has developed an excellent online resource. Go to their webpage. There are documents from court proceedings, newspapers, contemporaneous accounts of what's happened, including the trials. And there are some oral histories that were taken in the 1970s of people, black people, who were in Duluth at the time, describing how they reacted to this in the days after the lynchings. So there's some great resources at the Minnesota History Center's Duluth Online Lynchings Resource. If you want to learn more about this, it's a great source. We're taking the story from the book to the classroom to you. Look at you. 100 people on a winter night came out to hear what's been done. And you are the story today. And you represent what Minnesota has done. I don't think there's too many places where there'd be 100 people who'd come out on a dark winter's night when the temperature's going far below zero to hear something about the texture and depth of what these people have created. So I salute Joe, who got the ball rolling, wrote the grants, Carol, Michael for being the script writer, and all those who participated, as you are participating tonight. The next teaching cycle, I think, came quite unexpectedly after the republication of the book in the year 2000 with the genesis of an absolutely grassroots movement in Duluth by people like you who were indignant and outraged that this had happened in their city, when they got together and began to lobby for recognition of the fact that this had taken place in their city. And these were folks who were young. They had no connection whatsoever. Their grandparents probably had no connection whatsoever with what had gone on, but they thought it important to acknowledge the lives and to acknowledge the incident which took place in June of 1920 in their city. They were successful. After years of work, they acquired one of the four corners at the intersection where the lynchings took place in Duluth. The lamppost location is still there where the three men were hanged. They got the plot of land, Kitty Corner, donated to this project. They raised $300,000. Is that correct, Michael? Commissioned artwork, and the lynchings memorial is there. It's called the Clayton Jackson McGee Memorial, and they're online also, Clayton Jackson McGee. And they have developed a teaching curriculum around this and really has brought the teaching cycle full circle in that city and for a lot of other places too. So with their work, which was quite unforeseeable with the republication of the book in the year 2000, they brought the issue back to life in three dimensionality. There's a remembrance each year that's held in Duluth, and the story has not been lost. Ironically, we know the names of the three men who were lynched. We don't know the names of most of the 5,000 people who were in the crowd. They've passed into obscurity. But the names of Clayton, Jackson, and McGee live on thanks to their work. This was, by the way, correct me if I'm wrong, Michael, the first publicly funded lynching memorial in the United States. And it happened in Minnesota, and Minnesota said it was wrong, we need to do something about it, and Minnesota got it done. I'm very proud of that. The next step was taken with the development of this radio docudrama, which will project this story into the media worldwide and letting us take ownership of the fact that this took place. We know it wasn't right. We can't bring these three men back to life, but we can remember they lived. And we hopefully can learn from the dynamics that brought this tragedy to the fore. The remaining piece of this campaign, from my point of view, is to be sure that this Duluth lynchings incident is mentioned in the Minnesota statewide middle school textbook about Minnesota history called Northern Lights. And we intend to keep pressing to be sure that this event is noted in our state's history book that middle school kids get. So when they come to St. Cloud State, this won't be the first time that they've heard of this. And they can dive a little deeper into the facts surrounding the lynchings in Duluth.
At this time, I'd like to welcome the leader of St. Cloud State University's Community Anti-Racism Education Initiative, Dr. Deborah Lee. Deborah will help us understand what we can learn from this event and how we can support racial justice and end racism.
Thank you. And thank you all again for being here. This is a really intriguing story. It's one that we present as part of our history presentation during the anti-racism workshops that we do here on campus. By the way, how many of you have attended one of those? Okay? So you know what I'm talking about. You've seen this. It's not new for you. It's really interesting, though, because what happens in a community when they have a huge secret like this that they don't talk about? We fast forward 90 years to 2015 or 2010. I was invited to a meeting in Duluth in 2011 by the head of the YWCA, who asked me if I actually met her at a conference, the White Privilege Conference, which was held in Bloomington, Minnesota that year. And I did a presentation there with some of my colleagues. And she invited us to Duluth. She said that they were having a conversation about white privilege in Duluth. And there had been a lot of issues that were going on that people simply had not and could not talk about. They had not talked about things like the lynching. And actually, the organizers for the memorial were a part of the conversation. In fact, they were leading and pushing for the conversations. They were very interested in what was going on in St. Cloud. What did it take for those of us who were doing anti-racism organizing in St. Cloud to get started, to maintain the program that we've been doing? How do we talk about issues in our community? And how could we be involved in helping them to think through what would be right for Duluth? One of the things that was evident is that because we do anti-racism organizing here doesn't mean the exact same thing that we do here can simply be lifted from here and replanted in Duluth. It takes a lot more insider organizing and work from the people who actually live in the community in order to bring about the kind of change that was needed. You might imagine something like the lynchings being very difficult to talk about, it being a very difficult subject. And there was a lot of conversation about comfort, you know, whether or not white people were going to be comfortable having this conversation. And one of the things that we brought to the table was that we don't talk about white people being comfortable. We talk about saying the truth. We talk about what is it that we really need to be talking about, and how can we have those conversations? What kind of relationships do we need to be in to have those conversations? And there's a lot of learning that needed to go on around that. It was really interesting when a few months later we came back and we heard about the Unfair campaign in Duluth. How many of you have heard about that? The Unfair campaign? A few of you? So this was a campaign where, first of all, there was a lot of education that happened and a lot of organizing within the community to get people to the table to begin having conversations with each other. And then and perhaps Michael will want to talk about this a little bit too. But then there was an ad campaign that happened, and there was six billboards that were put up around town. One of them, for instance, was the picture of a white woman, and written across her face, under her eye and out of her face, was that it's hard for white people to see racism. And it caused such a stir in Duluth, with people talking about the billboards. And it was really interesting because there was a lot of backlash that happened as a result of that. There was the campaign was not only on the billboards, there was also a campaign on websites of the partner organizations. The workshops that they did brought together people from across the community, from many different organizations, to begin to really sit down and have some in-depth conversations about white privilege and what does it mean to be white, and how does racism play into it. One of the conversations that was really important was the conversation about racism being about more than simply racial prejudice. A lot of people have a view that that is all that racism is about, individual racial prejudice and behaviors. And there were other people who said, no, but racism is about more than that. It's about social access and social power. Access and social power. So it's not about whether or not you like me. It's more about, can I get a job here? Can I live in this community and not have to worry about somebody harming myself or my children? Can I go to the schools here? So often, if we don't have that conversation where we really talk about the two views of racism and begin to bridge that conversation, then we can't get in any further because we're just kind of talking past each other. And so they had workshops where they actually learned about racism and what it was, and then also some really hard conversations about white privilege. What is white privilege? How does it exist? And there was a lot of backlash and a lot of people that had never thought about white privilege or whether or not it existed or how they might be participating in racism in their community on an ongoing basis, and they simply weren't aware of it. At the same time, there were statistics that were just amazing in terms of the disparities that existed in Duluth. And people were outraged by the disparities, but they didn't understand how they participated in creating those disparities. And so the conversations were a starter for people to begin to really deal and grapple and struggle together with the issues that existed there. They shared their stories. They started by sharing their stories. The people of color shared their stories, and the white people shared their stories. And they listened to each other. And it was the result of listening to each other that helped them to begin to have a deeper sense of what was really going on. It brought about an awareness of the community, what got them to where they were. And it afforded them the opportunity to begin to open up to see different possibilities for the city and for the communities in Duluth. Our own journey in St. Cloud has not been much different from that, even though it wasn't through an unfair campaign, and even though there were no lynchings in St. Cloud, still the just like every place else in the country, white privilege is here, alive, and doing very well. And I know in my own personal experience coming to St. Cloud, I was saying earlier, I've been here for some 25 years. When I first came, racism was not something that we talked about. In fact, I was told by one of my colleagues, there are three things we don't talk about here. We don't talk about racism. We don't talk about religion, and we don't talk about politics. But you can talk about the weather and the Vikings all day long. And it was interesting to me because it was very true. Whenever you bring up the subject, it would quickly get shut down. But there were a group of people here that kept bringing it up and kept talking about the experiences that they were having and sharing their stories. And there was also a lot of backlash for that, for doing that. Just like there was in Duluth, the backlash was there. But that didn't stop the conversation. It didn't shut down the conversation. And one of the first things we have to do if we're going to begin to work towards solutions is to really talk to each other, to hear each other's stories, and to break the silence.
At this time, we have Nick can help with a wireless mic if you have a question of the panelists, and Jim as well. We'd like to engage your questions if you want to know more about the story from the panelists. This would be a good time to ask those questions. There's a question. Nick, down here.
My question is for Michael. I was wondering, how was the process of adapting your book into a radio play, and how long did that take?
It didn't take very long once I decided how to do it. I had about a half dozen false starts. I couldn't figure out how to make this work without just being long, descriptive narratives. None of you here are, well, there might be a couple of you who are old enough to remember an old television series called You Are There. I think it was Walter Cronkite. It used to be on Sunday afternoon. And they would reenact historic events in real time. So you would see these, even from ancient history, people dressed the way they would have 1,000 years ago, but there would be a CBS reporter there with his hat and his microphone, and he would be talking to them. And I thought, oh, well, it can be done that way. So once I decided there would be reporters on the scene, and this is like a radio report, even though there was no radio station in Duluth in 1920. But that was the way for me to get into this and to be able to make this work without lengthy descriptive narrations, which would be really boring to listen to.
The program opens with Desolation Row from Bob Dylan. If you want to mention why that song was selected, there's another question.
Well, because the song describes this lynching. Dylan's father lived with an easy walk just up the hill from where that lynching would have taken place, and he would have been probably about 10 or 11 years old when this happened. And it happened practically in his front yard. So there's no question that he knew it happened and obviously related it to his son, who put it into one of his songs.
Yeah, a question for Dr. Lee and Dr. Schreiber. Can you place this incident in the larger context of terrorism against African Americans, principally in the southern United States, from post-Civil War up to the 1920s, maybe 1950s?
Well, certainly there were a number of lynchings that happened, and the purpose of the lynchings were to terrorize people of color who lived in the community in many instances. So my short answer is absolutely.
Yeah, these were morality plays. In a twisted kind of way. They were designed to teach a lesson to the affected people. And one of the features of many American lynchings, especially in the South, was to leave the corpse dangling from the bridge, from where the charred remains were, as a emblem of further disrespect for the deceased. And in many cases, people were told, if you cut her down, you cut him down from the bridge, imagine Oklahoma in July, a woman hanging by the neck, dead, and the body would putrefy and be picked on by birds and other sorts of things very quickly. And nobody wants to have that disrespect, that further disrespect shown. And there's a book published in the year 2000 called Without Sanctuary. And it's a collection of lynching photographs in the United States, which makes clear that there was a narrative to many of these, whether by rope or by fire. The murder of principally African Americans, but there were a total of 20, I think, known lynchings in Minnesota. Only three, these three involving black men. The message was, you've done wrong, and this is what the people will do to you. But the fact that we leave the corpse, often this book, Without Sanctuary, shows posed pictures like the one in Duluth, where people are eager, they're crowding to get in the picture because, as I suggested before, this was the trophy shot. This was at the end of the dock with that big one on the end of your hook. This is something you wanted to be remembered for being a part of. This was a day of your glory for having done right by your people to protect white womanhood or whatever else the perceived injustice was. As slight as
as little as that could be justification for a death sentence in some places. So I think it was part of the typical narrative.
Another question.
It's a question for Professor Burry. You talk about the importance of education and how it should be used to teach, you know, young students about the history, the truth. But I would like to know what role does also, because it's more than cultural, social, and also moral, but it's institutionalized. So what roles like can politics play into that, or does politics have a role to play to change that perception?
Well, sure, and we'd like to think in a democracy the will of the people is reflected in laws and policies. And I was inspired by Michael's comment about Bonhoeffer to say we put pressure on the political system to make changes. Typically, legislation follows tragedies. Rarely is there wise, preemptive legislation. Usually, legislation comes from something bad that happened or some tragedy that happened, and the legislature says, never again, we'll try to avoid this by passing a law. And we are the ones who end up passing the laws with our protests. There have been lots of changes. One of the great benefits that only old people can understand is where we've come from in this lifetime. I'm 65 years old, and I grew up near Chicago and in a white middle-class family, went to an all-white high school with the exception of the occasional exchange student, but nobody of color that lived close by went to my high school. I missed out on that for 18 years. I didn't have a black friend till I went to college, and I played sports, but had a basketball friend who was black, played on our team. I got to know him, a couple fellas. But that was 18 years of my life where I had no experience with people of color, and I should have. But making change comes with us, and making change starts with courage. And making change starts with not letting a racist innuendo pass by, not letting a sexist presumption pass by, without saying, I don't think that's funny. May make you stand out with your friends to say, well, ooh, what's the matter with you? Nothing's the matter with me. I just don't think that was funny. That's a joke about black people. It's a joke about Jews. It's a joke about women. It's not a joke to me. It's a small thing, but it's doing something as opposed to being quiet. I think there were a lot of people who stayed quiet in Duluth as the mob, this juggernaut, was picking up speed. A few people spoke up. We heard some of those in the clip that was presented. But other people in the crowd didn't have the courage to say, they're right, he's right. Let's go home. Let the justice system take its course. Those voices would like to have been heard a day later, a week later, perhaps. But, you know, it's all about us. It's about us. And that's why I'm thrilled that you are here now, because it's all about you, the choices you make with your reactions to those kinds of comments, and where you choose to spend bigger pieces of your time to correct what you think are social injustices. So this has been a very, very positive event, and you've helped make this a very positive evening for me, and I think for all of us. So my hat's off to you for coming here tonight. Thank you.
I think also I saw a question in the front row, and then we'll go back up to you after that. Okay.
Hello. My question for the author was, could you talk a little bit about some of the roadblocks you ran into during publication and, as he said, the hard work getting it to come to fruition?
Yeah, I'd written this, was writing it, I suppose at the same time Alex Haley was writing Roots, but Roots hadn't come out yet. And I was getting many rejections on the manuscript as it went around. I think I stopped counting at 30 or something. That was pre-computer, and now when I finish a manuscript, I just click send, and there it goes. But back then, I had a manual typewriter, and I typed the manuscript, and you put it in a box that the typing paper came in. You wrapped it up, and you make sure to have enough postage in that so they can return it to you. Otherwise, it's lost. And then one publisher at a time, you just send the thing around. So the 30 or so submissions that I made, it took nearly 4 years, you know, to get all of those, and the thing would keep coming back. And I can still remember some of the rejections which seemed politically incorrect even for then. One of them said that while this was a very interesting and well-written story, we just don't think it would be a profitable for us to publish this because, and this editor said, black people don't read books. And one of the others said that it would just likely give somebody a reason to start another riot, and the other rejections were just, you know, the standard form kind of rejection. But I remember those two in particular. Publishers became interested though after Roots was successful, so. It was a long process. The first publisher was bankrupt. The second was bankrupt. The third, they still have a chance, but, I mean, they've kept the book around for almost 15 years now, so I'm not looking for a third bankruptcy.
Well, with that, thank you to our panelists this evening. And as I mentioned, please, if you want to continue the conversation or grab a cup of coffee or a cookie out in the lobby, we'll be out there to have a conversation with the panelists. Thanks, everyone. Thank you.